is one I came up with the other day, reading. Have you frozen a frog lately? You know, in the middle of winter, the wood frog showed no sign of life. It has no heartbeat, no breathing, and no circulating blood. Yet when winter is over and the ice melts, this frog returns to life as if it had never been frozen. Wood frog. Now, if we were to freeze a person, would he wake up? And to freeze a person, he doesn't wake up. So how does a frog do that? It goes on a sugar high. Before the frog freezes, its blood sugar level reaches a very high level. In fact, it reaches an extreme concentration. This excessive level of sugar, of glucose, keeps water from leaving its cells and it prevents shrinkage. The elevated level of sugar also reduces the liquid's freezing temperature, allowing only a very small amount of the inner body liquid to turn to ice in the cold. In addition, the glucose, sugar, feeds the cells through the winter when no other source of nutrition is available. It even prevents metabolic reactions like urea synthesis from taking place. Normally, an extremely high glucose level would kill a frog. So how does this elevated amount of glucose, sugar, come about just before the wood frog freezes? As soon as ice appears on the wood frog's skin, a message travels to the frog's liver to convert much of its stored glycogen into glucose. 5 minutes after the message is received, the sugar level in the blood starts to increase. Who could believe that this complex set of processes, and it is complex, all just happened by accident? I think that would be remarkable to think of that just happened by accident. But God, what Brother Stewart just read for communion meditation, God in his wisdom programmed into the DNA code of wood frogs a method for freezing them without killing them. I don't know about you, but I found that amazing. Wood frog. I don't know where they live, but that'd be something to behold. Our nature lesson for today. Last week, we ended with verse 13 of Acts chapter 2. And what some of the Jews thought about what was happening around them. This morning, we're going to continue with Peter's response to their questions, but specifically Peter's response to the accusation that was made in regards to the apostles, that they were drunk. And it's a powerful proclamation. And later we're going to see how Peter, what the Lord gave him, later we're going to see how Peter uses the first key to the kingdom that Jesus had given him. Now, this is the day of Pentecost, traditionally. So, as we would see it from the scriptural standpoint, today would be the day of Pentecost. And this is what happened on that day of Pentecost, back in 30 AD. Well, in this morning's message, I want to center on what Peter said. And then next week, we're going to look at the response, because there's a lot in here. I was going to go through the whole chapter, but that's too much of that. Too much for that. We'd be here for quite a while. So we're just going to look at verses 14 through 36 this morning. I believe we need to understand from the outset that this is more than likely just a part of what Peter and the apostles said. It's not all what they said, but it is what Luke has recorded for us. What is important that his hearers and his readers would understand. It is a condensed version of what Peter proclaimed that day and the other apostles. So let's look at that text, beginning with in Acts 2, beginning with verse 14. But Peter, now here's another way that you can see that this involved the apostles, not the 120 and not others, but the apostles. Notice what happens here. But Peter, taking his stand with the 11, it's all 12 of the apostles, raised his voice and declared to them, "Men of Judea and all who live in Jerusalem, let this be known to you and give heed to my words. For these men are not drunk, as you suppose, for it is the third hour of the day. But this is what was spoken of through the prophet Joel. And it shall be in the last days, God says, that I will pour forth of my spirit on all mankind, and your sons and your daughters shall prophesy, and your young men shall see visions, and your old men shall dream dreams, even on my bond slaves, both men and women. I will in those days pour forth to my spirit, and they shall prophesy. And I will grant wonders in the sky above and signs on the earth below, blood and fire and vapor of smoke. The sun will be turned into darkness and the moon into blood before the great and glorious day of the Lord shall come. And it shall be that everyone who calls on the name of the Lord will be saved." So let's stop and digest that a little bit before we go on. What we have here is what a powerful proclamation that Peter is giving here. He makes a stand with the 11. The other apostles are agreeing with what he says. Because while they are speaking in these other languages and they're declaring the mighty deeds of God, they're also proclaiming what Peter is saying as well. That's what it means when it said, "And Peter took his stand with the 11. It wasn't just that Peter declared what was going on, proclaimed what was going on, and gave reasons for what was going on. They all did. But Peter is undoubtedly, and what we see here is we see a new insight that is given. Peter undoubtedly is the leader here. But all 12 of the apostles were involved. But Peter is the main speaker. And it says that he raised his voice. It means like he more than likely had to shout. And why would he? Because of all that was happening around him. What all these men were saying. You can imagine the cacophony of the noise that was going on. And then you have these men of Judea who are saying, ha! These men of Galilee, they're drunk. That's what it is. They're drunk on sweet wine. And they're hearing that. And so Peter had to shout above them to get their attention. So he raises his voice, and he specifically, if you look at the text, he specifically, who he mentions first is very important. He specifically points out the men of Judea. Why would he do that? Well, it stands to reason that these were the ones who were shouting to all these others, what's going on? I'll tell you what's going on. These guys are drunk, that's what. Well, they're from Galilee. You know, they're not like us. They're not from around here. They're from Galilee. That's probably what they were thinking. Maybe even saying. That's why he points out, specifically, first of all, men of Judea. You pay attention, listen to what I'm going to say. Then he addresses those who were staying in Jerusalem over that Pentecost week. That's what it means when he says, and all who live in Jerusalem. He's talking about those who are visiting over Pentecost. He said, let this be known. Very emphatic in the Greek. Let this be known and pay attention to what I am saying. Says, these men are not drunk. And then he gives the reasons. That would have been a violation of the feast day, for one. That's why Peter mentions what he does. He says, you give heed to my words. These men are not drunk. Now he's including himself. That's it. He was saying, we're not drunk. These men are not drunk, as you think. It's only the third hour of the day. It's the third hour of the day. Now, what's the significance about that? See, that's why he's giving a reason for why they are not drunk. And what's going on? It's only about 9 a.m. That's the third hour of the day. Remember when the Lord was crucified? About the third hour of the day. See, the Jews divided the day into 12 equal parts between sunrise and sunset. It was divided into 12 equal parts. And so now it's the third hour of the day. Because again, it's about 9 a.m. And what is significant about that? And why does Peter bring that up? That they would not be drunk? Because if that was the case, since it's the third hour of the day, 9 a.m. in the morning, and it's on a feast day, that would be a violation of the Jewish law for them to be drunk. And they wouldn't do that. They're in the temple. They're at the temple area. And furthermore, Peter mentions that it's the 9 a.m. because that is the morning hour of prayer. That's what the apostles were doing there. We learned that in Acts chapter 1. They didn't know what was going to happen. They didn't even know what was going to happen on the day of Pentecost. They were just told to wait in Jerusalem. And while they were waiting, they spent time in prayer. That's what they're doing. So Peter, he's telling them, No, 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 we're not drunk. It's 9 a.m. It's the morning hour of prayer. And it's also a feast day, the day of Pentecost. So what Peter, in essence, is saying, he's saying, guys, man, can you see the absurdity of this? You're saying we're drunk? Can you see the absurdity of the accusation these men of Judea are putting forth? So now Peter begins to quote from the prophet Joel. And if you look at Joel chapter 2, verses 28 through 32, you'll find that. But now here's the thing, when you're reading Joel chapter 2, verses 28 through 32, if you turn there, Peter is not quoting from the Septuagint, neither is he quoting from the Hebrew. It doesn't read exactly like Peter says. But it is a fulfillment of prophecy. Now, what he says here in verse 16 is important. But this is what was spoken of through the prophet Joel. Can you imagine some of these religious leaders and these men of Judea around, and Peter begins to proclaim, and he brings up the prophet Joel? Can you imagine what some of them are thinking? That these guys are from Galilee. How do they know anything? How can they say these things? How can he say this? How does he know that? But he does. And he doesn't. Notice what he does. He doesn't pull out a scroll. He's not at the synagogue. He's in the temple area. He doesn't pull out a scroll and say, see what Joel says right here? No. He quotes it, as I said, not directly from the Septuagint, nor from the Hebrew. But he does quote it. What that means is that Peter is under divine inspiration here. It says that they're speaking as the Spirit gave them utterance. And he says, this, what is this? This does not refer to the baptism of the Spirit upon the apostles. That's what some want to teach, but this does not refer to that. The word this is a demonstrative pronoun that has an antecedent. That antecedent is found in verse 12. Verse 12 says, and they all continued in amazement and great perplexity, saying to one another, what does this mean? What does this mean? That's the antecedent of what Peter says in verse 16. This, what does this mean? What's going on? What are these men saying? Why are they doing this? It is the miraculous ability, this, when he said that this is what is spoken of through the prophet Joel. It is the miraculous ability that the apostles were able to speak in those various languages that they did not know. That's the this. Not the baptism of the Spirit. Not the Spirit coming upon them. These men around them did not know or did not see the Spirit coming upon them. That was only experienced by the apostles, by the 12. But that this was what those around them were hearing of what was going on. Thus it concerned what they were doing, not what happened to them. This is important to remember and to teach, because many want to focus on what happened to the apostles. That what happened to the apostles can also happen to them and should happen to them. But that is part of the fulfillment of the prophecy in Joel. No, it's not. That this refers to what was going on around them, of what they were doing. Not the fact that the Holy Spirit had come upon the apostles. We must never forget that. It's important to remember, and it's important to teach. Now, what he says here, when he quotes Joel, the last days refers to the whole time from Christ, for the whole time from Christ until the judgment day. When he quotes this prophecy from Joel, it is not limited just to the day on Pentecost. It's not just limited to that. Not all the things that Joel prophesied about that he mentions, that Peter quotes here, happens on the day of Pentecost. Blood and fire, vapor of smoke, the sun turned into darkness, moon into blood, that did not happen that day. Even where he mentions, sons and daughters shall prophesy. Young men shall see visions, old men shall dream. Well, come on, the bond slaves, both men and women, that did not happen on that day. But it will. The baptism of the Spirit came upon the apostles. As Brother Gareth Reese said, this pouring forth of the Spirit was a measure of the Spirit that resulted in miraculous manifestations, prophecy, visions, and dreams. The power which the Spirit himself exerted over the minds of the apostle after he entered into them is figuratively called a baptism. While the term pour forth expresses the act of Christ in sending the Spirit from heaven. Now notice what he says here. And it shall be in the last days, not just this day, but in the last days, plural, God says that I will pour forth of my Spirit on all mankind, on all flesh, and your sons and your daughters shall prophesy, and your young men shall see visions, and old men dream dreams, and so forth. What is implied here, brothers and sisters, is a distribution to all flesh. But it includes both Jews and Gentiles. Not just Jews. No Gentiles are here, just the Jews are. Now, the Gentiles will come much later, and we'll get to that much later. So what Peter is saying, he is quoting this, but not everything that he is quoting is being fulfilled, as I said, on that day, on the day of Pentecost. It's not fulfilled on one day. But as we go through the book of Acts, we're going to see that the first part of what Peter quoted here was fulfilled. In other words, they're living in the last days. But brothers and sisters, the last days are not over. We're still in the last days. We will be in the last days until he comes again. Now, that last part, when he says here, of verse 18, the last part of that is not in the text. Even neither in the Hebrew. That's why I'm saying Peter's not quoting from the Septuagint nor in the Hebrew. It's not found there. It's not in the original quotation if you look at Joel chapter 2. And they shall prophesy. Peter added this. Peter added this under divine inspiration. And notice the plural is used here. And as we go on and you read verses 18 through 20 there were no cataclysmic events on that day of Pentecost. He is referring to the last days, to the judgment day, to when Christ comes again. You compare. See what Peter is saying here. You compare that with Matthew chapter 24, verses 29 to 31. What did Jesus say there? But immediately after the tribulation of those days, the sun will be darkened and the moon will not give its light and the stars will fall from the sky and the powers of the heavens will be shaken. Then the sign of the Son of Man will appear in the sky and then all the tribes of the earth will mourn and they will see the Son of Man coming on the clouds of the sky with power and great glory. And he will send forth his angels with a great trumpet and they will gather together his elect from the four winds, from one end of the sky to the other. And you read what Peter writes. Now remember what Peter is quoting on the day of Pentecost. Now look what he writes in 2 Peter chapter 3, verses 10 through 12. And you see how this goes together. But the day of the Lord will come like a thief, in which the heavens will pass away with a roar, and the elements will be destroyed with intense heat, and then the earth and its works will be burned up. Since all these things are to be destroyed in this way, what sort of people ought you to be in holy conduct and godliness, looking for and hastening the coming of the day of God, because of which the heavens will be destroyed by burning, and the elements will melt with intense heat? It is evident that this part of Joel's prophecy is yet to be fulfilled. And it will not be fulfilled until Christ's second coming, the final judgment day. Revelation chapter 6, verse 12 and following says, I looked, when he broke the sixth seal, and there was a great earthquake, and the sun became black as sackcloth of hair, and the whole moon became like blood, and the stars of the sky fell to the earth, and as a fig tree casts its unripe figs when shaken by a great wind. And the sky was split apart like a scroll when it was rolled up, and every mountain and island were moved out of their places. That's his coming again. That's the judgment day. Then the kings of the earth and the great men and the commanders and the rich and the strong and every slave and free man hid themselves in the caves and among the rocks on the mountain. And they said to the mountains and to the rocks, fall on us, hide us from the presence of him who sits on the throne and from the wrath of the Lamb. For the great day of their wrath has come, and who is able to stand? That's what Peter is referring to there. He's not saying that it has come to fruition on that day, but it will. Notice what he says in verse 21. And it shall be that everyone who calls on the name of the Lord will be saved. Everyone who calls on the name of the Lord shall be saved. From what? From what you read in Revelation chapter 6. From the day of judgment. Be saved from what? From hell. From what those men were saying in Revelation there. Having to want the rocks to fall on them. Why? Because they could not stand to be in the presence of the one who was coming. That's Christ. But Peter says, it shall be on that day that everyone who calls on the name of the Lord will be saved. That has a reference to Jesus. It has a reference to his character and to what he did. It's a plea for salvation. And with that as a launching point, Peter begins to tell them about Jesus. Verses 22 through 36, he says, "Men in Israel, listen, pay attention, listen to these words. Jesus the Nazarene." Peter's pointing out that Jesus is not from Judea. He wasn't from Judea. He came from Nazareth in Galilee. You know that place you despise, that you don't like? A man attested to you by God with miracles and wonders and signs which God performed through him in your midst, just as you yourself know. And this one, this man delivered over by the predetermined plan and foreknowledge of God, you nailed to a cross by the hands of godless men and put him to death. But God raised him up again, putting an end to the agony of death, since it was impossible for him to be held in its power. Peter's message is calculated, brothers and sisters. Peter's message is calculated to make those men reel and stagger as they are under a rapid succession of heavy blows. And Peter begins, after he quotes Joel, he begins to get very personal with these guys. Very personal with this audience. That's why he calls them men of Israel. He's getting their attention. He's coming at them from where they are. He acknowledges that they are men of Israel, that all of them there are. Part of Israel. Of Jacob. And he does this to get their attention. And he proceeds to convince them, to persuade them that Jesus was the Messiah. Because Peter refers to Jesus' divine mission. He said that these things were this person, Jesus of the Nazarene, he was attested to you by God. Now, maybe not all of those around there, the Jews, had seen what Jesus had done, but many of them that were in the audience, they knew what Jesus had done. They had seen what he had done, what Peter says here, the miracles he had performed, the wonders that he had done, the signs, that's why he mentions these three things. and that God performed them through him in your midst. That you're not ignorant of these things. That's why he said, just as you yourselves know. He says, you're not ignorant of it. You know. They knew that. Why? Because many of them had seen what Jesus had did. Maybe even perhaps many had experienced it. Then he says, God allowed sinful men to nail Jesus to a cross. That's why he said, this man, delivered over by the predetermined plan and foreknowledge of God, you, those in the audience, you nailed him to a cross by the hands of godless men and put him to death. Talking about laying a guilt trip on someone, that's what Peter was doing. Peter was laying it on to him. The predetermined and foreknowledge of God, the Old Testament, and they knew this, the Old Testament and Jesus himself predicted his death. They knew the suffering servant passages in Isaiah 52 through 53. The predetermined plan and foreknowledge of God, it was God's plan made in eternity. But that takes nothing away from Jesus' free will. If he had wanted to, Jesus could have avoided the cross. That's why he told the apostles what he did. Don't you know I could ask my Father and he would send me more than 12 legions of angels? It was his decision all the way. Jesus went to the cross of his own choosing. Remember what we read in John, what Jesus told his disciples and others, that no man takes my life. I lay it down on my own initiative. It was his choosing. That's why all the agony in Gethsemane. Now, it is true that God determined the plan of redemption. That's what Peter is talking about. But God did not force his son to go through with it. He chose to do so. That's what it means when he's talking about the predetermined plan and foreknowledge of God. That this was God's plan of redemption. Peter puts the responsibility on the hearers, on those who are hearing. The godless men that he mentioned, well, that's Pilate and the Roman soldiers. And yet, who is it that Peter charges with killing the Messiah, with putting him to death? He said, you put him to death. Yes, Pilate and the Romans were the means of doing so, but they cannot escape their responsibility. But yet, Peter said, God raised him from the dead. Let us not miss this, for it is Peter's main point of his message, of his proclamation, is that of the resurrection. It is central to believe this. Did you know when you read this text, verses 14 through 36, when you read through the text, is only one verse. Only one verse mentions the death of Christ, and that is verse 23. You put him to death. That's the only one. But the resurrection is mentioned in 9 verses. 9 verses. But God raised him up again, putting an end to the agony of death. The agony of his death. But also the agony of death overall. Since it was impossible for him to be held in its power. Meaning Christ. Now Jesus' agony, his suffering was done when he said, Telestai, it is finished. It is completed. Because, and we know then that Jesus gave up his spirit to the Father. His suffering was over. What he, and the why he was doing it was over. Death could not hold him. I like what J.W. McGarvey said years ago concerning this. Never did mortal lips announce in so brief a space so many facts of import, so terrific to the hearers. McGarvey said, we might challenge the world to find a parallel to it in the speeches of her orators or the songs of her poets. There is not such a thunderbolt in all the burdens of the prophets of Israel or among the voices which echo through the apocalypse. It is the first public announcement to the world of a risen and glorified Redeemer. That occurred on the day of Pentecost. And now Peter bolsters his message with proof from the Old Testament. He says, I'm not done here. I told you what that has been attested to you. But now he said, let me show you from the Word, from the Scriptures, how Jesus was the Messiah. And so that's why Peter quotes from David. For David says of him, I saw the Lord always in my presence, for he is at my right hand, so that I will not be shaken. Therefore my heart was glad and my tongue exalted. Moreover, my flesh also will live in hope, because you will not abandon my soul to Hades, nor allow your Holy One to undergo decay. You have made known to me the ways of life. You will make me full of gladness with your presence. So he's quoting, Peter is, from Psalm 16, verses 8 through 11. Now this gives us also, brothers and sisters, this gives us evidence of the inspiration of David. When it says he was always, I saw the Lord always in my presence, always beholding, literally what it means. That's in the imperfect tense. And what it denotes is habitual action. Not a one-time thing, but a continual habit, a continual action. And it says, I saw the Lord always in my presence. I fixed my attention on Yahweh. And then he says, for he is at my right hand, so that I will not be shaken. That's a reference to Jesus. It's not a reference to David. David is, as it were, prophesying here. And the reason why Peter quotes this, Psalm 16, verses 8 through 11, is that Peter is referring to Jesus. He's referring to the Messiah. He's saying he will not abandon him to Hades. And Hades is not the grave here, like the New International Version incorrectly translates it. Neither is it hell, as the King James Version incorrectly translates it. Or that would be Gehenna. But it's not the grave that he's talking about here. talking about Hades, the abode of the dead. He said, you will not abandon me there, and God did not. It's true that he went to the abode of the dead. It's true he went to paradise, but he's not there now. And where he's at now, he's at the right hand of the Father. Notice what Peter says next in verse 29. How he says it does not refer to David. He says, brethren, I may confidently say to you regarding the patriarch David that he both died and was buried, and his tomb is with us to this day. And so because he was a prophet, David, and knew that God had sworn to him with an oath to seat one of his descendants on his throne, he looked ahead and spoke of the resurrection of the Christ, that he was neither abandoned to Hades, nor did his flesh suffer decay. David was being prophetical here. And Peter, speaking with boldness, said, you think this refers to David? And he said, I'm telling you it does not. It refers to Jesus. It refers to the Messiah. David's dead. We know where his tomb is. His tomb is still in sight. His tomb was on the south side of Mount Zion, the western hill of the two hills on which Jerusalem was built. You can imagine Peter pointed that. But this one, Peter is saying, was not dead. He was saying David was not raised from the dead. We still know where his tomb is. We still know where his body is. Therefore, the psalm does not refer to David. David looked ahead into the future. You read Psalm 89, verse 3 and 4, and Psalm 132, verse 11. That's what in 2 Samuel chapter 7, verse 11 through 16. David asked God to have someone remain on his throne. And God told David he would. But it didn't refer to David's progeny. That's a literal king sitting on the throne. God has something else in mind. That it would be the Messiah. He was speaking about the Christ. Now notice what he says. This Jesus, God raised up again, to which we are all witnesses. What is Peter saying? Remember, Peter stood and took his stand with 11. And what he's doing, you can imagine him pointing it out, telling them. God raised him from the dead, and we are all witnesses, all of us, 12. We are all witnesses of that. They're witnesses of Jesus' resurrection. And now notice what he says in verse 33. He states where Jesus is now. He says, therefore, having been exalted to the right hand of God, fulfillment of Psalm 16, and having received from the Father the promise of the Holy Spirit, he has poured forth this which you both see and hear. What he's telling them what we are doing and what you are hearing, it comes from him. He now reigns on David's throne. And David's prophecy is fulfilled. That's why he says, for it was not David who ascended into heaven, but he himself says, the Lord said to my Lord, sit at my right hand until I make your enemies a footstool for your feet. Therefore, he concludes his message. Notice what he says. He says that Jesus now reigns on David's throne at the right hand of God for all eternity. And Peter says that Jesus is responsible for what they are now hearing. And again, verse 34, he quotes David again from Psalm 110. Now notice how Peter concludes. Therefore, let all the house of Israel know for certain, no mistake, it's a certainty. Peter is telling them, you can bank on this, that God has made him both Lord and Christ. And notice what Peter does again. He won't let them off the hook. He concludes with the affirmation that God made Jesus both Lord and Christ, the Messiah. He says there's no possibility of mistake in this. It's a certainty. And notice how he ends. Therefore, let all the house of Israel know for certain that God has made him both Lord and Christ, this Jesus whom you crucified. Three times he tells them that they are responsible, that they are guilty. So he ends with the fact that they are guilty of putting to death the Messiah. Imagine what that did to them. Some of them probably didn't do much, didn't do anything. But there was a whole lot of them that it did do something to. And we're going to look next week at the response that they made to Peter's message. But see, this goes to the heart of us as well. Because Jesus died on that cross for us as well. We can't have forgiveness of sins without that. We can't have forgiveness of sin unless he did what he did. We cannot have forgiveness of sins in eternal life if he did not resurrect, overcome death. Because we cannot overcome death if he didn't. We'd just die. But we wouldn't be resurrected. And we wouldn't have eternal life. But Jesus, what he did for us, that gives us. But let us not think that if we had been Jewish, if we had been one of those men and had been there, would we be no less guilty? Let us not think that we would say, oh, no, don't crucify him. You're crucifying an innocent man. No. If we were to put ourselves in their place, we'd probably do the same thing. If we were under those same circumstances, many people would do the same thing and are doing the same thing to the Lord today by denying him, by denying who he is, by not surrendering all to him. So let's stand. We're going to sing, I Surrender All. That's what he wants. He wants us to surrender all to him, not just some of our life, not just a little bit of it. Next week, we're going to see their response, Peter's answer to that, and how significant that still is today, and that is still essential.